This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. Until recent years, very little was known about domestic violence. It happened in secret, and no one talked about it. Not the families involved, nor the professionals who might be suspicious about a mysterious bruise or a broken bone. That has changed, spurred by legal cases, advocacy groups, physicians, researchers, and therapists who have uncovered the pervasiveness of the problem. Dr. Neil Jacobson has been working with couples in abusive marriages to try to understand the dynamics of their relationship. Jacobson is a professor of clinical psychology at the University of Washington. He and his colleague John Gutman undertook a long-term study of 200 such couples. They observed their fights up close and monitored their heart rates and other physiological reactions. The results are revealing and included in their new book, When Men Batter Women.
We tried to look at the underbelly of domestic violence as directly as we possibly could by bringing people into the laboratory and hooking them up to polygraphs and videotaping and coding their arguments. Of course, we didn't allow any violent altercations to occur in the laboratory, but we were there watching as they argued, and then we followed them over time to see when and under what conditions women would get out of abusive relationships, and we also looked to see if the violence ever stopped.
Let's talk a little bit about the study that is the basis of this book. First of all, tell us what kinds of sensors you attached.
We used the polygraph with the capability of collecting a lot of different kinds of physiological data so that we could look at various channels by which people get excited when they're arguing and to try and distinguish between fear, sadness, anger, and some of the different emotional states that people can't really tell you about with any degree of objectivity because they distort the experience shortly after it occurred because batterers often minimize and distort their experiences to make themselves look more favorable. The heart rate doesn't lie. And so we were able to, I think, for the first time, understand what's going on at the physiological level during these arguments.
So you're looking at things like heart rate and blood flow and pulse and all the
blood pressure, skin, sweating, movement. All of these things, usually there is a typical response physiologically during an argument. When couples argue, they usually, their heart rates go up, their blood pressure goes up, they sweat. They get excited physiologically, and there's this overall arousal that occurs, which is common even among abusive couples. And as you know, because you've read the book, we found this quite astonishing phenomenon among 20% of the batterers.
Yeah, let me ask you about that. You found that with 20% of the batterers, and again, this is looking at the sensory physiological information that you got, that there was actually a decrease in their heart rate when they became aggressive in an argument. Explain what that finding tells us.
Okay, well, it tells us it was probably the single most important discovery in the study. If you can try and imagine being in a relaxed state and then starting to argue, because we had everybody relax for 2 minutes prior to the beginning of the argument. And then we found that among 20% of the men, they actually got calmer as they became more aggressive at the behavioral level. So they looked like they were candidates for a stroke or a heart attack.
So they were yelling and screaming and
yelling, pointing. Screaming, pointing, interrupting, belligerent, contemptuous, domineering. And meanwhile, we're talking about heart rates that are as low as 35 beats per minute. We began to think of them as being sort of like cobras who get very calm as they're about to strike. And indeed, there's literature to suggest that when people calm down during stress and conflict, the function of that calming is to focus your attention. So why would they want to focus their attention? Well, to maximize the impact of the aggression. So we have a group of men who calm down when they get more aggressive in order to maximize the impact of their violence. These are men who are the most severely violent. They're the most emotionally abusive. They're the ones with long criminal histories going all the way back to adolescence and sometimes earlier. Almost all of them are psychopaths. They usually have alcohol problems, and they're also addicted to illegal drugs. And the marriages are remarkably stable. That is, they don't end very quickly.
Looking at these two different kinds of batterers, what kind of impact did they have on the women, on their wives, and in terms of their reaction to what he was doing?
Well, the wives who were married to Cobras were much more frightened. They were much less inclined to get out, even though the violence was more severe. They were more depressed, and they suppressed their anger. Whereas the wives married to pit bulls were much more inclined to take their husbands on, and also much quicker to leave. By now, 1998, even though we met these people for the first time in 1990 or 1991, by now virtually all of the women married to pit bulls are out of those relationships, except in those rare instances when the violence actually stopped. But the Cobra wives are very, very reluctant to leave, and most of that is because they're afraid to.
We're talking to Neil Jacobson today. He's co-author of a new book. It's called When Men Batter Women, New Insights into Ending Abusive Relationships. For the sake of our discussion and from the research and work that you have done for 25 years, if we're talking about abusive relationships, are we talking about men battering women?
If you're talking about heterosexual relationships, married or unmarried, battering is almost exclusively something that men do to women, and rarely something women do to men. Very, very occasionally you find what we called in our book Bonnie and Clyde couples, mm-hmm. where the battering was truly mutual. But they're rare, and they don't come into contact with therapists very often. Now, you sometimes get couples where that's the way it looks on the surface. But if you probe deeply enough, you find out that the woman is the one who's battered. Of course, you also have gay and lesbian relationships where indeed men batter men and women batter women. But we're talking in our study about, and in our book, about heterosexual relationships.
Let me try another question on you, because this I have also heard, which is that the woman will goad him and taunt him and yell at him, and then he will finally hit her. How much of that have you observed?
We observed the opposite. I hope, again, our book puts an end to that myth. First of all, there's nothing that a woman can do to force a man to hit her except to try to inflict bodily harm on him. So no matter what she were to do to him verbally, that wouldn't be a justification for him using violence toward her, nor would it be the cause of the violence. Men hit for reasons that have nothing to do with what women do. Now, our research supports that empirically, so we now have proof mm-hmm. that's the case. But even thinking about it logically, you can't force someone to hit you. We had one example of a wife who said to her husband at a time when he was having trouble getting an erection, you must be a fag just like your father. So she was insulting him, and insulting his father wasn't very nice. He then punched her in the face. And she called the police, and he was arrested and charged with assault. He was guilty of assault, despite the fact that what she said wasn't very nice. Mm-hmm. In fact, however, it's not typical for men to hit because women taunt. It's more common for men to hit for reasons that have nothing to do with anything the woman has done. He walks in the door and he smacks her in the face. She hasn't done anything. Women are violent under very predictable conditions, like when someone is hitting them, they may defend themselves. Male violence is not predictable by anything that the woman does except withdrawing. When the woman withdraws while she's being beaten, that increases the likelihood that the beating will get worse.
Increases the likelihood.
Increases the likelihood.
Why?
So there's virtually, because it annoys him and irritates him and angers him that she's trying to get away. He's not done beating her yet, and she should stay and take her beating, according to the man. But there's nothing that the woman can do to affect the likelihood that he will start hitting her, stop hitting her, hit her harder, or hit her softer, except trying to get away, which will typically make the beating worse.
What do you see as the relationship between physical abuse and emotional abuse? Does one naturally lead to the other?
Well, most batterers, in fact, virtually all batterers, are also emotionally abusive. And sometimes, as time goes on, they become less physically abusive and more emotionally abusive, because emotional abuse takes on the same controlling power that physical abuse has, and it's not against the law. So it can look like the violence has stopped, but in fact the woman is under control as much as she was when she was being beaten, because the emotional abuse is a reminder that at any moment the physical abuse could resume.
Dr. Neil Jacobson is our guest, and we're talking about his research on domestic violence. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Neil Jacobson is our guest today, and we're talking about a book he has just co-authored. It's called When Men Batter Women, New Insights into Ending Abusive Relationships. Do people in abusive relationships fight about, argue about what everyone else does? They just express it differently, or are there things that they argue about that are distinctively different?
Well, for the most part, they argue about everything all over the map, but I think there are a couple of distinctive arguments that batterers and battered women have, and there's a lot of arguing about sex, because batterers want sex whenever they want it, whether the woman wants it or not. And that generates conflict. It's not the best. It's not an aphrodisiac for women when men demand sex, whether women want it or not. And then there's the issue of jealousy. Jealousy is a very common trait of batterers, and they're made jealous very easily. In fact, I would go so far as to say that's one of my red flags. We have a chapter in the book where we talk about red flags, the things to stay away from in men. I'd almost like to be able to interview the men who former clients of mine meet so I could check out these red flags, but one of them is jealousy. If the man will not allow his girlfriend, wife, or partner to have friends of the opposite sex, or gets jealous about those friendships, that's a very bad sign.
Your study shows that there are different kinds of batterers, but what do you say to reports that others have said that batterers often act contrite and apologetic after a beating, and that there can be a kind of honeymoon period and flowers and gifts and where he wants to make it up to her? Any evidence of that?
I think that phenomenon exists, but I think it's been vastly overstated in the early literature. People sort of glommed on to that finding when Lenore Walker first published it in the 70s, we found that to be the exception rather than the rule. Now, you do have some men who don't feel right about the fact that they're batterers. And when I find a man like that, I think that, wow, at least I've got someone here who may stop at some point because it's not consistent with their value system. But the vast majority of men either fake the remorse or it's very, very short-lived and temporary.
In talking about this relationship and in trying to answer the question why a woman stays in an abusive relationship, you found that many don't. And I think that's another myth that has endured, that women stay and take it.
Yes. When I speak to groups of advocates for battered women, I suggest that when they get asked the question, why do women stay, the answer they should give is they don't, mm-hmm. because that's really the truth. They leave. It's just a question of how long it takes them to figure out a safe exit because they have to avoid getting killed. They'd like to avoid getting stalked. They'd preferably like not even to be beaten. And it's very difficult and sometimes takes years to orchestrate a safe escape. And as we know all too tragically, some of the escapes don't work.
So you're saying that a woman who stays doesn't mean she isn't planning and figuring out some kind of an escape plan.
Exactly, and it takes years to come up with. It's not just a safety plan; it's also a plan for financial independence. Because a lot of battered women are financially dependent on their husbands, and many of them have children, and they know they're not going to get child support from these men. So how are they going to survive, and how are their children going to survive without this financial support? So they have to somehow develop this financial dependence without the batterer realizing that they're developing a safety plan. It's not easy. And it takes a while.
You say that abuse over time can decrease, but it rarely stops. Are you saying that in most of these relationships, they don't exhaust themselves? They don't ever give up? It's still that the dynamic that keeps this relationship so volatile and so dangerous never goes away?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that nobody has really studied couples over the course of an entire lifetime.
Right.
And so we don't really know what percentage of couples actually succeed in developing a normal relationship. But what we do know is that in our sample, it was very rare for the violence to stop. And especially for the violence to stop along with the emotional abuse. What was more common was for the violence to go underground and be replaced by emotional abuse. And this essentially put the men beyond the reach of the law but gave them as much control and power over their wives. Or we saw the women leave. And so I think what happens is over time, either the violence gradually gets transformed into emotional abuse, or it simply continues, or the woman gets out. And eventually, by 20 years later, by 20 years after we've met them, most of these relationships are resolved, are dissolved, either because someone gets killed, usually the wife, but more commonly because she gets out. And she gets out not unscathed, but she gets out.
Well, it's interesting because, as you have said, we know a lot more about domestic violence. We know a lot more about abusive relationships. And yet the problem continues at a fairly scary level. And I'm curious about then where do we go next? We meaning as a culture and people like you that are researching this problem.
Well, I'll tell you where I'm going next. I've put my resources and my energy into strengthening advocacy for battered women. I want to study different methods of advocacy. I'm interested in following women into their next relationships. I'm interested in helping strengthen the technology that currently exists in advocacy programs. And at the policy level, I'm interested in lobbying for the funding of programs which give women an opportunity to rebuild their lives after they've been through this concentration camp-like experience.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Neil Jacobson, for joining us today on Fresh Air. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Neil Jacobson is the co-author of When Men Batter Women. I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is Fresh Air.